I'd like to welcome you all to the Center for Great Plains Studies and the Paul A. Olson Seminar Series. Next, I'd like to introduce Donna Scheer. She's the director of the University of Nebraska Press. Donna?
One of the first inter-campus meetings I had was with the folks here at the Center for Great Plains Studies about this monumental undertaking. It was exactly the kind of meeting I was glad to have about exactly the kind of book I was glad to be publishing. At the University of Nebraska Press, we have a special commitment to this campus, to this state, and to this region. The Atlas of the Great Plains is precisely the kind of project that fulfills that mission. It's a project that draws upon the expertise of the center, as well as several faculty members and graduate students. It's a book that's vitally important to the state and the region. As many of you have seen the reviews know, the 300 original full-color maps in this book cover everything from what you'd expect, like population growth and density, ancestry, which, by the way, apparently 25% of people are of German ancestry in the Great Plains region, temperature, irrigated farmland, corn and wheat acreage, rainfall, and to things like modern bison inventory, crime rates, sources of revenue for public schools, birthplace of artists, performers, and writers, and on and on. My personal favorite map in the whole atlas is the one entitled North America and the Great Plains at Night, because it shows how unlit we are compared to the East and West coasts, and is probably why we sleep better than they do. The book has already received some very impressive reviews, particularly in the Lincoln Journal Star and the Omaha World Herald, and it's selling well. As of yesterday, it was number 24,809 on Amazon, which is actually very impressive. It was number 2 in historical atlases, number 6 in regional geography, and number 14 in atlases in general. So obviously, lots of people agree with us about the importance of this undertaking. Before I turn this over to Rick, I'd like to acknowledge the hard work of so many people at the press, including Heather Lundeen, our former editor-in-chief, Bridget Barry, who worked behind the scenes until she's finally been able to step up and take over Heather's list, Sabrina Stelricht, who was the project editor, who shepherded the book through the editorial and production process, Kara Pasek, who has been phenomenal in marketing the book, and all of the other people at the press who are so proud, as I am, to be part of undertakings like this. I'd also like to thank the hardworking editors and acknowledge how sad we all are at Steve Lavin's passing. We'd like to thank the other editors for their efforts and to thank Jim Stubendick and the Center for all of your help and assistance on the book and on so many other projects that we do. As we do for all the books we collaborate with the Center, as well as the Sheldon or the Quilt Center, we're very honored to be part of the university and its mission to serve the state of Nebraska and the Great Plains region. Thank you.
Thank you, Donna. Next, Rick Edwards is going to introduce the speakers. Rick?
Thank you, Jim, and thanks, Donna, for those comments. The Olson Lectures are always special. This one is even more so. We're here to celebrate and learn about the Atlas of the Great Plains. Now, scholars associated with the Center for Great Plains Studies have produced three great, indeed monumental, scholarly works. The first, the Journals of Lewis and Clark. I only brought one volume. This is one of them, edited by Gary Moulton. The second, the Encyclopedia of the Great Plains, edited by David Wishart, who's sitting in the back. And, of course, the third, the Atlas of the Great Plains, which makes it a hat trick. Weighty scholarship. Before I turn to the authors of the Atlas, I would like to say just a brief word about collaborators in all three of these endeavors and in much else besides. The University of Nebraska Press has been a stalwart and valued partner, and we certainly thank them and thank you, Donna, for that collaboration. The Atlas was produced by this very talented team of Clark Archer, Steve Lavin, and Fred Shelley. As you know, Steve Lavin died a few weeks before the publication of the Atlas after years and years of dedicated and patient scholarship that made multiple contributions to the Atlas. His work lives on in this beautiful Atlas. We are joined today by Steve's widow, Ruth Lavin, and son, Peter Lavin. Thank you for joining us today. Clark Archer took his PhD at the University of Iowa in 1974. After brief teaching stints at Missouri, Dartmouth, and Oklahoma, he came to Lincoln in 1985, and he is now a professor of geography in the School of Natural Resources. Fred Shelley also took his doctorate at Iowa in 1981. How Steve, a Kansas PhD, had the patience to put up with these two Hawkeyes is surely one of the untold mysteries of this atlas. Fred moved directly from Iowa to the University of Oklahoma and is now professor in the Department of Geography at Oklahoma. Much, much more could be said about these three talented geographers because they have achieved so many honors and accolades. For example, it's already been mentioned, the editorial just last Saturday in the World Herald, the full column editorial about the Atlas. Now, as you know, the World Herald generally reserves full column editorials for railing against public waste and for denouncing proposals to cut ethanol subsidies. But this time they used the page to praise at length the Atlas and its editors, concluding, "Congratulations to the University of Nebraska Press and to these three scholars." And I might add, to the Center for Great Plains Studies and to Jim Stubendick, on whose watch these three great works of scholarship have been produced.
All right, the way we're going to proceed is I'm going to speak for a while about how the Atlas was put together, where some of the information came from, how it's organized in total. And then once we get to roughly the population material, Fred is going to take over. Now, this actually follows more or less the division of labor on the Atlas. I did a fair amount of the GIS work, collecting some of the data, numerical data. Steve Lavin did a lot of the map refining work, and Fred did quite a lot of the writing. So the sequence that we're going to be following actually follows pretty much what the division of labor on the Atlas was. But before we get started, there are a number of people that I would like to thank, a number of institutions that I'd like to thank. William Condon and Sandra Condon helped with a contribution. The Omaha World Herald did. The UNL Arts and Humanities Research Enhancement Fund and the UNL Center for Great Plains Studies helped in so many ways that I really can't think of. It would be not reasonable to try to list them. Some of the administrative supervision, promotion, and assistance, Professor Stubendick, Center for Great Plains Studies, the Publications Committee kept asking us, well, you know, how is things going? Susan Norby at the University of Nebraska Foundation helped in lots and lots of ways. Gretchen Walker helped to be sure that we got the dollars and cents, the columns worked out right. Joyce Hurst at the Geography Program helped quite a bit too. Now, a lot of those money that were devoted to the Atlas, the various contributions, a lot of those funds were used to support student assistants. And most of those students' assistants are now holders of MAs or PhDs from the University of Nebraska. But they're listed there. They're acknowledged in the beginning. Data assistance and other support, we had support from Mike Hayes, Ron Zelt, Statistics Canada, Bureau of the Census, and lots of others that I'm sure that I'm forgetting some here. And the University of Nebraska Press, from our point of view as editors, did an absolutely marvelous job of organizing the Atlas, taking the maps and the text and putting them together, and a beautiful job of laying the Atlas out. So I'm really very well pleased with the University of Nebraska Press's important contributions to the Atlas. Now, one issue of importance in endeavoring to do an Atlas of the Great Plains is that question, where are the Great Plains? And this is on page 2 of the Atlas, one of Steve Lavin's students, and he researched the Great Plains, the maps of the Great Plains, and 50 different scholars had 50 different Great Plains. Now, this is not a yes-no, right-wrong sort of thing. Different interests, different perspectives. There are a number of great plains. Now, there are areas that overlap, and you can see in the western part, there's a fair amount of agreement as to where the Great Plains end on the west. Not so, a little bit on the south and a little bit on the north, but quite a bit of diversity of opinion about where they end up on the east. Now, for a while, I was editor of the Journal Great Plains Research, and occasionally I would get a manuscript that I wasn't quite sure how to respond to it, but I remember one that came from some authors in New York, and they were talking about some flat areas in western New York State. And I went back and I said, well, you may be talking about plains, but I don't think really that that this is an appropriate journal for your manuscript. But other cases, when they'd come in from various places in Iowa, for example, I have to admit that that eastern boundary is problematic. So one question is where they are. Now, David Wishart, who's here and who was wrote the preface and did a really nice job, this atlas was intended to be a complement, not a supplement, but a complement to the Atlas of the, or to the Encyclopedia of the Great Plains. And I think that David's boundaries of the Great Plains have to be regarded as authoritative, so basically we follow them. But it won several awards, as you probably know. Now, I'm going to take a few moments here to talk about how the atlas is organized. And, of course, we spent a lot of time thinking about what should go into the atlas. And there were several criteria, but one is it had to be about the Great Plains. Another is that it had to be potentially interesting, and most importantly, it had to be something that we could get information on, and I'll elaborate on that a little bit. But the chapter organization, which evolved through time, the beginning, land and environment, if you've not read the, or looked at the atlas yet, it's a good idea that the introduction that John Hudson wrote is, I read it again this afternoon to sort of refresh my memory, and John Hudson really did a marvelous job on that introduction. But it's worth taking a look at that. It's also worth taking a look at that beginning point about the atlas, using the atlas and reference maps, which talks a little bit about, admittedly, nuts and bolts things about what maps are and how to interpret them. But then land and environment history, Native Americans, bison, exploring the Great Plains. Steve Lavin and his students did a lot of the work on the exploring the Great Plains portion, looking for source documents, etc. Population density, ethnicity and race, demographics, ancestry. Rural settlement and agriculture, homesteading and farms, livestock, crops. Urban settlement and economy, urban characteristics, employment, energy. Politics and government, which is actually something that Fred and I have been interested in for a long time. We've published a fair amount on geography of elections, legislative seats, recreation and services, recreation, media, sports, medical information, artists, performances, social indicators, education, crime, religion, other social indicators, and then there's a big bibliography at the end. And that big bibliography at the end documents where our information came from, and I reread that again too before speaking this afternoon. And there's a fair amount of material information about where you can get good information on all sorts of things for the atlas. Now, we ended up deciding that the region to map would be extend beyond the Great Plains as defined by or defined in the Encyclopedia of the Great Plains, and there are a couple of reasons for that. One is if you recall that earlier map showing the various Great Plains. There's some doubt about just exactly where the eastern boundary is. For somebody interested in vegetation, do you use the short grass prairie or the tall grass prairie or the mixed grass prairie? For somebody interested in culture or politics, where are the divisions? There's a fairly sharp divide, for example, in voting patterns east and west of the Missouri River. But there are also divisions north and south. If we were looking at economics, different styles of farm structure and so on. In other words, each of these different topics in the atlas can suggest, in a sense, a different interpretation of where the Great Plains are. So we ended up deciding to map the area essentially between the Mississippi River and the Rocky Mountains to provide context. In a way, it's almost the Louisiana Purchase plus the Texas annexation, plus those three Canadian prairie provinces. Now, adding Canada to the Atlas actually added an awful lot of complexity to getting data that would match between the U.S. and Canada. And for example, the Canadian dollar and the U.S. dollar trying to get equivalences, that's something that I more or less gave up on. And so some of the maps, the 49th parallel is very wide, okay, and it shows up on the maps. In other cases, it's pretty narrow, where we could get matching data. But how to handle the problem of missing data on a map? Now, one way is to go on the internet and get photographs from the Congressional or U.S. Library of Congress's Western History Collection and just, you know, put them around in various places to cover up where the we don't have the data, okay? Now, that, after all, is actually what cartographers used to do. I mean, you know, people snicker about those flowers and dragons on the maps. Well, they were positioned very carefully in order to cover up the areas that either, A, they didn't know where they were, or, B, they didn't have the right kind of information, okay? But, you know, one of the things about a map is, if you don't have the data, if something is missing, it's pretty obvious right away, okay? Whereas with prose, you have to read a long time before you finally figure out that, well, you know, something just didn't end up, but on a map, it's pretty obvious right off the bat. For each map, we need what or feature data, accurate data on features or phenomena to be represented on the map. We need where or locational data, an accurate base map. We need when or temporal matches between the where and the what or when. Now, if we were to try to map, for example, data from either the Canadian census or the U.S. census for, let's say, 1890 using a 1990 base map, we'd encounter a lot of mismatches. So the data and the base map have to correspond. And now also there are all sorts of things about map design decision regarding issues such as map projection, scale, data classification, symbolization, et cetera. And here's where I'm just going to mention these and then go on. But all sorts of sources, and obviously I put the Encyclopedia of the Great Plains in a prominent place there. I basically went over to the shelf or several shelves and picked out things that look fairly photogenic. But we looked at lots of stuff to try to get a handle on the what, where, and when. A lot of our data are from various government sources, both U.S. government sources, state government sources, and Canadian national government and provincial sources. And this is actually just a small portion. Maybe this is about half, I suppose, of all the items. Now, unfortunately, modern data are often very readily available on the internet or somehow or another, but historical data often are not. And so one of the things that the student assistants, one of the ways that they contributed was they did an awful lot of hand typing using documents like that or like these. And I also did an awful lot of checking because I found that some students were more accurate than other students. But trying to keep things as consistent as possible. Now, you need not only data, but you also need a base map. And for a geographic information system, which is a wonderful sort of thing, my first introduction to cartography, I was using an ink pen and an instructor just about, that was just about the end of my cartographic endeavor, until I discovered later on that I could actually use computers, and that was a lot more fun. And also, I didn't have to use nearly as much whiteout, okay? You just let the computer plot it, and then if it doesn't work right, you throw it away and start all over again. But with a paper map, that's hard. But these are some of the source documents. One of the things that made the Prairie Provinces challenging is there are no counties in the Prairie Provinces. And so the statistical units are census divisions. Unfortunately, they change from census to census. So getting a good Canadian base map for 1890 doesn't really help trying to map Canadian data for, let's say, 1990 or 2000 and so on. There's an awful lot of very close, careful work to defining the boundaries. Now here I also had some our natural resource boundaries to draw upon. But you can see this is actually zoomed in on a fairly small area, one of the maps, and this is making the boundaries of the Canadian census divisions for, I think, 1901. And of course, that has to be matched exactly with the characteristics data on, let's say, immigration. And also, it's necessary to be sure that the U.S. Census definitions and reports on immigration and things like that match the Canadian census and vice versa. Sometimes the matches were pretty close, and we didn't have any problem. Other times, we had to be fairly creative. But the next step was to use Atlas GIS to put the data sets for Canada and the U.S. together and to create an intermediate map using Atlas GIS and doing the data classification. A fair amount of work sort of behind the scenes trying to figure out what data classifications would display, represent the data effectively. And one of the problems we had with an atlas like this that extends over a period of time is the data classifications for, let's say, 1901 and needed to be comparable to the data classifications for 2001 in order to ensure that when you turn the page on in the atlas, that you're comparing apples to apples from one page to the next and not apples and oranges. So that is sort of another one of those behind-the-scenes map design issues of considerable importance. The next step, and this is where, so up to this point, Steve, or I've been doing a lot with Steve's assistance, but from this point on, Steve is doing a lot, taking my maps and then making them so they were presentable, selecting the right line weights. He was outstanding at that. His talents with the use or with color and typology and all that sort of thing, just outstanding. He was one of the best map design cartographers in the United States, academic map design cartographers in the U.S. So there's foreign-born population. Those maps then were the ones that were finalized and are the ones that are printed in the Atlas of the Great Plains. Now, there are other cases where we couldn't rely on government data. We had to go to other sources. One is, for example, in education. And so we looked around for data source for this. This actually has all the addresses for colleges. And so we went through this and entered it into a database and then did something called geocoding, which translated those street atlases into latitude and longitude. And the latitude and longitude values were the values that were used to position the symbols correctly on the maps. So this is another GIS step. In this case, the maps are proportional circles, and the circles are proportional to the enrollments, undergraduate enrollments in those various colleges and universities. And then after that draft map was converted to something presentable by Steve, this is the fine Adobe Illustrator map layout that appears in the Atlas. There are all sorts of other things. There are reference maps at the beginning, and the reference maps are the ones that indicate where the cities and towns and various features are at several different scales. Steve was wonderful with this sort of thing. There were some other things. One of the things that I tried to figure out was how to map drought, okay? And I know there's a drought mitigation center here, but I had trouble trying to grasp that figure, and so I needed data on most of the information that I was able to find about climate and weather were averages or normals. But averages or normals don't tell you much about drought because some years are wet and some years are dry. And in order to produce that map, eventually we found information indicating annual rainfall totals for a number of stations across the United States. I tried for about a year and a half to match that data set with Canadian data, and we failed, which is why the 49th parallel shows up conspicuously on that map. But the Canadian sources were pretty good about annual average snow or annual average precipitation. It would be interesting to try to extend that map up there north, but you'll notice that those ISO lines trend very much north-south, and so variability, there's a shift in variability of rainfall more or less on the eastern boundary of the Great Plains. Now, I will admit that if I'd chosen a different isopleth value for the ISO lines, it might look a little bit different. So there are other things, ecology, tall grass, short grass, savanna, and so on, and this came from folks who know more about ecology. Other kinds of things, pattern of Native American tribes. Now, one of the things I discovered, it's very difficult to do maps of where tribal areas were. They were not nearly as sticklers for boundaries as Euro-Americans are. So These are approximations, and we looked through a number of different reference sources. And so these tribal locations are more or less approximate, but the tribes, by the way, are also classified by their linguistic relationships. So that's the color coding. Different Native American language families and subfamilies. Another thing is the horse, and of course, horses are very important. In reading and looking for information about Native Americans' uses of the horse in the Great Plains, one of the things I found was that the Spanish did not want Native Americans to get horses much at all. In fact, according to some of the documents or some of the sources that I read, that was an executable offense to give horses to Native Americans. So the question then became, how did the Native Americans get the horses? And there was at Santa Fe, about 1650 or so, the Native Americans took over the Spanish Santa Fe, kicked the Spanish out, and that's probably how horses got introduced to Native American tribes. And that's the diffusion. And you will notice that horses didn't get to the northern and central Great Plains much before European Americans did. So the horse was really horse and Native Americans, very short period of time. There are maps of the exploration routes, and these maps, the information on these maps comes from lots of different sources. Military forts and trading posts, and you can pick out, for example, the Missouri River pretty effectively. You can also see the Platte River. So these came from all sorts of different sources. This is another good example of where it was difficult to try to cover both the U.S. and Canada, because the criteria for a trading post or the criteria for a military post in Canada were different from the criteria in the United States. So there were difficulties of trying to get data that really didn't match very well at all for Canada and for the United States. The decline of the bison. Now, of course, cattle are very important on the Great Plains today. They essentially replaced the American bison. And by the time Nebraska came to be settled for agricultural purposes, the bison were pretty well gone. But they vanished in only a very short period of time. And this is that map of the Great Plains at night. And I think Fred is going to take over from this point forward.
Okay. What we're going to do is I'm going to continue what Clark just started, and that is to kind of walk you through some of the maps that we found in other parts of the Atlas, pretty much going in sequence as in the table of contents, as Clark brought up. And, of course, when we finish, we certainly welcome questions and comments from all of you about these maps and other ones that we don't talk about directly today. But the first thing we're going to talk about is the population. You all know population density refers to number of people per square mile. And we have pretty accurate population density of Euro-Americans starting in 1810. As Clark mentioned, much of the Great Plains in the United States originally became part of the U.S. through the Louisiana Purchase in 1803. And the U.S. takes a census every 10 years, in years ending with zero, as I'm sure you know. And so the first census of population in the Great Plains came in 1810. Now, I should point out that the Native Americans to the 19th century were not counted. We don't know how many there were. Census takers did not make any effort to count them. But this is essentially Euro-American and also African slave populations over the first several maps. But you'll notice that essentially only the area around Louisiana itself had any significant Euro-American settlement in 1810. And you see it begins to pick up a little bit, particularly around New Orleans, Baton Rouge, and then around St. Louis is established by 1820. Here we go to 1830 and 1840, and you begin to see settlement, particularly along the river courses, along the Mississippi, and increasingly along the Missouri, up to Mississippi to what's now Burlington, Iowa, along the Missouri, west to Kansas City, and so forth. Then we move to, this is 1850 and 1860, and it's this period where we really begin to see settlement of what's now the Eastern Plains begin to take off. As you see, by 1860, at the beginning of the Civil War, much of Missouri was fully settled. The eastern two-thirds of Iowa was. settlement had begun here in Nebraska and eastern Kansas, southern Minnesota, as far north as the Twin Cities, and so on. Civil War in the first half of the 1860s, we essentially see a halt in migration, but we also see then a big pickup in settlement between 1860 and 1880. One of the key events, as you may know, is the Homestead Act of 1862. This was a law that gave free land to any settler who settled the land, lived on it, improved it for a five-year period. And this attracted many, many people, both immigrants and people who were from the eastern part of the United States, Civil War veterans. And this is really the key event. I understand that there's going to be a symposium on the 150th anniversary of the Homestead Act next year here at the Great Plains Center. But anyway, you see that settlement really picks up by 1880. Much of eastern Nebraska, much of Kansas is now settled, Texas, the eastern half of Texas, and so on. And this trend continues into the beginning of the 20th century. Now, you notice the slash 1891. That is because Canada now starts taking censuses. They take their census every 10 years in a year ending in one. So we have the 1891 Canadian census plus the 1890 U.S. census here. And again, we see a continued pattern here of populating the area. The whole 19th century is really a period in which we see the population of the Great Plains from east to west. Now, and this continues into the 20th century, where we see by 1920, after World War I, we see pretty much continuous settlement in much of at least the U.S. portion of the Great Plains. Less so in Canada, but you also see a continuation of settlement in Canada as well. Now, by 1920, in fact, many areas of the Great Plains had more people then than they do today. Much of rural Nebraska, for example, had more people living there 1920 and 1930 than we have nowadays. And as we look through the rest of these maps, you'll notice how the plains begin to empty out. Notice how we see a decline in the population density in many areas. Okay, and so this goes 1930, 1940. Here's 1950 and 1960. And you notice that the population densities in rural areas really begin to decline. And you see also the urban areas really stand out. This, of course, is a function of many people moving from rural areas, farm communities, to cities. Okay, and we'll just quickly go through the rest of these maps, and you'll see the same pattern continue. By 1980, 30 years ago, you could easily pick out Omaha, Lincoln, Denver, Dallas-Fort Worth, Edmonton, Calgary, Alberta, and so on and so forth. Here is the maps for 1990 and 2000. Unfortunately, this was done before the 2010 census came out, but the 2010 census map will look quite a bit like the 2000 map with these same trends continuing. Depopulation of rural areas, more and more settlement of urban centers in and around the Great Plains. And again, you can clearly see Lancaster, Douglas County, and so on standing out on these maps. Okay? Now, we also talked about components of population. How does a population change? People are born, people die, people move. Okay, and so these maps show the birth rate and the death rate. Birth rate is simply the number of people born in a given year as a percentage of the existing population. And you see how these birth and death rates vary here. Death rate, of course, is the number of people who die as a function of the existing population. And in some parts of the Great Plains, death rates are higher than birth rates. And this, of course, means that the population goes down, you know, unless people are moving there faster than they are moving out. But reduced population is very much characteristic of many parts of the Great Plains. Okay. Now, that leads to what we call natural population change. Natural population change, in effect, is the difference between the birth rate and the death rate. And the map on the left, the county shaded in areas of Canada, shaded in red and pink, had a net loss in population. In other words, more deaths than births. The ones with the green shades had higher birth rates than death rates. And again, you see the urban areas stand out. Okay, again, you can pick out easily the Denver area, you can pick out the Dallas area, the Twin Cities, and other areas that have attracted larger metropolitan populations. And on the right, you see the migration rate. How many people are moving in or out of a particular place per 1,000 people? Okay? And so a net migration rate of minus 20 means that 2% of the population moved away. Okay? And again, the green represents an increase, the red a decrease, and again, you see the same kind of urban-rural pattern. Okay. Now, of course, also we can look at population by gender, population by age, the maps here show the number of younger people, number of older people. The one on the left is an estimate of how many people there are in 1951 aged 14 or younger. Baby boomers or just pre-baby boomers. And then you see on the right the number that are over 65. Now, here's the same information for 2000, the most recent data we had when we put the atlas together. And you'll see, again, the number of kids tends to be fairly low. The main exception here is, as you may be able to pick out in places like South Dakota, are areas with large Native American populations. They still have a much higher birth rate and a younger population than do many other areas of the Great Plains. Now, look what happens to the number of people over 65. Okay, Nebraska has one of the higher average ages of any state in the country. This, in part, is because the birth rate is not that high, but even more so because, in many cases, the older people, young people are born in Nebraska, they grow up, they go to college, they leave, their parents are still, as they get older, are still here. Okay, so again, you see rural Nebraska really stands out. The darkest shade there is 26% or more of the population is over 65. Okay, in some places where the percentage of people over 75 or 80 is in double digits. Okay, now, here's the Native American population. You see the correlation there with what we just looked at, where you see areas with high Native American populations, particularly in northern Canada, in Dakotas, New Mexico, also were the places that had fairly high birth rates. Here's the African-American population, and what you see here is, of course, before the Civil War, many African-American slaves living in Louisiana, Arkansas, and Texas. After Civil War, of course, slaves were emancipated, but many of their descendants continued to live in these areas. One of the major changes here by 2000 is that you see an urbanization of the African-American population, in the Great Plains, but all over the country. And again, you see significant African-American populations. The shadings represent percentage of the overall population. But again, you can pick out the Kansas City area, you can pick out Omaha, you can pick out the Denver area, areas such as cities in West Texas, as having significantly more African-Americans than you have in rural areas. Okay. Now, as Clark, or I believe Donna mentioned, a quarter of the population of the Great Plains have German ancestry. There's a number of maps that show various ancestries. Here's a few examples. You see the percentage of people that are of Polish ancestry, Scottish, Swedish, and Ukrainian in these maps. And what this reflects is, in many cases, a pattern of what we call channelized migration. What that means is that entire groups of people from the same ancestral area, even the same town in, let's say, Sweden, would move to the same place in the Great Plains. So you have areas in, you see a few counties here in Nebraska, which have significant, you're all from Nebraska, more familiar with them than I am, but you see these areas with significant Swedish populations. One Swedish person, perhaps, would travel to this area, homestead land, write back to their friends and relatives in the old country saying, hey, this is a good place to go, why don't you move to Nebraska? I'll help you get a farm, I'll help you learn English, get you settled. And so you'd have entire populations of towns in one area of Sweden, let's say, moving to southern Nebraska, just like you see on this map. Okay. Now, of course, how these people got there often depended on the availability of the railroads. How they were able to sell crops once they had their farms depended on railroads as well. So this map, there's a series of maps showing the railroad lines as they existed at various times. This one is 1885. And you see the major transcontinental railroad lines. The first one, of course, was the Union Pacific and Central Pacific that was completed in 1869. That goes through Nebraska. By 1885, there were several others that you see listed here. Okay. And, of course, agriculture has long been a mainstay of the Plains economy. There's a chapter in the Atlas on the Plains economy. And so you see here, this is the number of head of cattle per county, or by census division in Canada. Okay, the overall number of cattle has gone up. But you see also the distribution has changed. You have more cattle concentrated in a few areas. Agriculture has moved to larger and larger operations. You have cattle on feedlots. No longer does an individual farmer keep a milk cow or, you know, a couple of cows just for milk and so on their farm. Okay, and so you see concentrations of cattle, particularly in the southern plains, the area from around Lubbock north into southwestern Nebraska, has the largest concentration of meatpacking in anywhere in the United States. Okay, same thing here for sheep, and you see that sheep really have almost disappeared from the Great Plains. There was major sheep industry in 1900, as you see, especially toward the Rocky Mountains, more in Texas in 1950, but then the sheep industry is pretty much gone. Okay. Here's wheat acreage. This one you see is more stability, and you have really two areas of major wheat production. The area to the north in Canada, the Dakotas, is spring wheat, planted in the spring, harvested in the fall. Here into the south of us in Kansas and Oklahoma is winter wheat. The wheat is actually planted in September or October, lays dormant over the winter, and then grows and is harvested in May and June in the spring. Okay. Now here's grain sorghums. Grain sorghums, milo, and so on have become a major crop in the Great Plains. Again, you see how the changes. You see the concentrations of sorghum and also soybeans. Soybeans is part of the major crop rotation, of course, here in eastern Nebraska, in Iowa, and many other areas of the plains as well. It's really become, after corn and wheat, the major cash crop in this area. Now, of course, people recognize their connections to the Great Plains. In many cases, you have businesses that have the words Great Plains in their names. What we did here was simply identify, this is one of the painstaking types of research that Clark's students did, was to simply identify businesses that had Great Plains as part of their names. And then you map them here. And you see that, in some ways, this is a good indicator of where the Great Plains are. If you're going to call yourself Great Plains, you better be in the Great Plains. So you don't see very many in Arkansas, probably none in western New York, going back to Clark's article, but quite a few, obviously, in Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, and so on. Now, we all associate the Great Plains with agriculture, and if we look at in 1950, 1951 in Canada, what is the percentage of people employed in agriculture? Okay, the darkest blue is over 50% on this map. So in other words, in the darkest shade of blue, half of the workforce or more were in farming, either as farmers, farm laborers, and so on. Mining was on the right. And you see mining areas in a few places. Other areas, obviously, no minerals. There's no mining employment. Okay. Now, how does this change by 2001? Well, first of all, the census changed the category. In other words, they lumped together forestry, fishing, hunting, and agriculture. So this obviously not too much commercial fishing in the Great Plains, so this wasn't too much of a difference. But you see how the percentage drops. Here, the darker shade is 20%. Okay. In other words, you don't have any counties anymore that have 50% farming. Okay. Nowadays, well under 10% of the Great Plains workforce is in farming. In fact, only about 1% in the U.S. as a whole. Mining, you see a significant increase in some areas, particularly with oil production, coal production in places like Gillette, Wyoming, oil and natural gas in western Oklahoma, and in west Texas. Now, where are these oil fields located? Of course, this is an indicator of where the employment is. There's going to be people working in oil fields where there's oil fields. And so you see the at the top there where oil fields are located, and the two maps at the bottom show amount of production by state in each of these areas. I don't believe, Clark, you can correct me, I don't believe there were data here for Canada, because obviously, as you may know, Alberta has become a major area for oil shale production, particularly northern Alberta in recent years. Okay. Biodiesel, ethanol, production. These, of course, are highly controversial, but they tend to be concentrated, as you might expect, in agricultural areas where there are crops that are suitable for conversion to biofuels. Now, extra, read all about it. The Great Plains, relative to many parts of the country, has always had a strong tradition of education. Literacy rates have always been very high, in part because people lived somewhat isolated lives. They slept better at night, but there weren't as many people to talk to. Newspaper circulation levels have always been high. People relied on newspapers for news. And this map shows the number of newspapers originating in various cities, with the size of the circle representing the circulation. So you see the Omaha World Herald and the Lincoln Journal Star show up, large newspapers in Dallas, Denver, Twin Cities, and so on. You still have a lot of small daily newspapers in smaller communities here, and then some of these show up. Grand Island shows up, for example, places like Bartlesville and Enid, Oklahoma, places like Amarillo, some of the other small communities around the plains. Okay. Cultural activity, okay? Symphony orchestras. What communities maintain a symphony orchestra? And the size of the circle represents how many concerts a year does the symphony orchestra put on. And as you might expect, the bigger cities have large enough populations to support a symphony orchestra, to buy enough tickets to keep the orchestra going, pay the performers, and so on. Rodeos, of course, cost less per, you don't need as many people in a rodeo as you do in a symphony orchestra, so they tend to be more scattered in rural areas. And you see this is where rodeos that are sanctioned by the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association were held in 2007. Okay. National historic landmarks. I'm sure you know the Haymarket District here in Lincoln, the William Jennings Bryan home here in Lincoln are national historic landmarks, and there are many others. These dots represent places that have been designated as national historic landmarks by the U.S. federal government or the Canadian federal government as of 2007. Powwows, these are celebrations of Native American culture. Okay? And many of them are also, for lack of a better word, tourist attractions. They attract people who want to observe Native American culture, and they have art exhibits, dances, music, and crafts, paintings, and so on. And each dot here represents a powwow, many of which are held on an annual basis. And again, you see the concentration of these events where you have substantial Native American populations. Oklahoma, as I'm sure you know, has a very large Native American population, not on reservations. Many of these people are descended from Native Americans from the Southeast, who were forced to move to Oklahoma in the 1830s and 1840s. But there's a very strong revival of interest in Native American culture, particularly in Oklahoma, and this is reflected in the number of powwows here. Okay, unfortunately, you may not be able to see this, but as Clark indicated, we looked at well-known writers, artists, other cultural figures who came from the Great Plains. Each dot represents a person of cultural significance who came from somewhere in the Great Plains. You know, for example, right, they appeared in the encyclopedia, but some of them, of course, are not so much known. Dick Cavett, for example, from here in Oklahoma. Okay, Larry McMurtry from northwestern Texas. William Allen White, the famous editor of the Emporia Gazette, shows up there as well. Selected performers, and again, the colors distinguish actors, TV personalities, dancers, directors, and you see again famous people like Tom Brokaw, Tommy Lee Jones, Douglas Fairbanks, and quite a few, Johnny Carson, quite a few others that came from this area of the country. Hospitals. Healthcare is, of course, an important issue anywhere in the country, and with an aging population, it's become increasingly important here in the Great Plains. Not only do you have an aging population, but you have more and more people that are relatively isolated from major medical centers. Okay, so this shows hospitals with the size of the dot representing the number of hospital beds. In other words, the bigger the dot, the bigger the hospital. And, of course, again, you see a concentration in large cities and in university communities, such as here in Lincoln, Iowa City, Iowa, Boulder, Colorado, where you have large numbers of hospitals. And access to health care is becoming a more and more important issue in an area with a declining population in general and a larger and larger elderly population. Okay. Now, as Clark mentioned, we have a long-standing interest in political data and elections. There's a series of maps in the Atlas that show the outcome of presidential elections by county going back to 1892, as you see here. 1896, the map in the bottom, was a pivotal election in U.S. history. William Jennings Bryan, of course, from right here in Lincoln, was the Democratic candidate for president. The counties, following the convention we have nowadays, we used red for the Republicans and blue for the Democrats. The counties that Bryan carried in 1896 there are shown in blue. His opponent, William McKinley, beat him primarily by winning most of the eastern, and at that time much more populated eastern area of the U.S. in that election. Now, let's compare this to the most recent elections of, we have 2000, 2004, 2008, and as you can see, these are pretty similar. If you, someone not familiar with the United States saw this map, and they would have thought, oh, McCain must have won in a landslide. Well, of course, he didn't, and we know that the reason he did not had to do with the fact that Obama's strength was concentrated in urban areas. That's why he got one electoral vote here in Nebraska, because he carried the congressional district, including Omaha. Okay, but you see here that the Republican, John McCain, carried almost all of the counties in the Great Plains, all of them, in fact, in Oklahoma, the large majority of them elsewhere in the Great Plains, particularly in rural areas, with the exception of areas that had large Hispanic populations, as in South Texas, Native American populations, as in South Dakota, and so on. Okay. Now, this looks at the number of seats in state legislatures. Okay, that what? Oh, now I'm sorry, national legislatures. Okay, how many members of Congress come from the Republican and Democratic parties, and from the various political parties in Canada? Okay, we have a series of maps then on religious adherence. Okay. What percentage of the population belonged to various religious organizations? The one on the left is Baptist, and the Baptists really dominate the Southern Great Plains. There are more, the name Southern Baptist, of course, implies the South, and you see that the percentage of Baptists drops off as you get north of Oklahoma and Missouri. Anglicans and Episcopalians are shown in on the map on the right. They're much more prevalent, as we found in Canada. Lutherans on the left, again, this reflects patterns of immigration. Most Scandinavians, many Germans who moved to the U.S. Partly to homestead were Lutherans, and they brought their Lutheran faith with them, and in many cases their descendants who live there today still practice Lutheranism. So you see the dominant religion of North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, and the Newberry areas is Lutheranism. There's also a substantial population of Germans in central Texas, which explains the pattern there as well. Mennonites, you see here, particularly in Canada, some populations of Mennonites in South Dakota and in Kansas. And I think that's it. We have, I'm assuming that we would certainly love to entertain discussion and questions. I assume that's the plan. So let me thank you, and please feel free to ask any comments about either these maps or others that may be in the Atlas or any other suggestions you may have. Thank you.